This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. Japanese immigrants in the West from the early 1900s became vital to California's growing farm economy. Masakazu Iwatu wrote in the Journal of Agricultural History that by 1941, two generations, Issei and Nisei, were, quote, producing between 30 and 35% by value of all commercial truck crops grown in California, as well as occupying a dominant position in the distribution system of fruits and vegetables, both wholesale and retail. And this is where Christian Kiefer roots us in his latest novel, Phantoms. In Placer County, it's the early 1940s on the Wilson family farm, where Hiro Takahashi and his family are vital contributors and their friends. So Dr. Kiefer, as I'll introduce him, is a professor at American River College and director of the Low Residency MFA at Ashland University. It's been a while. I'm so happy, Christian, to have you back on Insight.
Thank you so much.
This story happens in a place where you grew up.
That's right. Yeah, Auburn's my hometown. That side of Placer County is definitely where my roots are and where I still live.
The internment part of the story is before your life there. Why did you want to go there?
Well, growing up in that county, we did have internment probably briefly in our history books, maybe for a paragraph, but it wasn't really clear that that happened exactly where we live. And the more I researched it, the more profound it seemed. In fact, there was a turning point where I got some back issues of the Placer High School yearbook, and the yearbook editions from 38, 39 were probably close to 50% Japanese and Japanese American faces. Mm-hmm. After the war, there were maybe 6 or 8 Japanese faces in the whole book. Some of that can be ascribed to the opening of the Del Oro High School campus, but you know what I found out is many of the people from Placer County who came back after internment weren't welcomed and moved on to places like San Jose and Oakland.
So this book opens with Ray Takahashi, Hiro's son, coming home from World War II. There's really no home at that point to come back to. And as you just said, there's some question about how much that was happening in Newcastle, in Auburn. But the book really changes from that point into our narrator, who we meet next, John Fraser. What went on for you as a writer between that beginning and where we go next?
Yeah, my whiteness got in the way, essentially. I am not somebody who thinks white male writers need to be taking up space talking about race in this country. I think there's a good many topics white male writers don't need to be addressing. I think we could be listening a lot more and talking a lot less. Nonetheless, I'm a writer with only one idea at a time. So until I can get the idea out on paper, the next idea doesn't come. And I also felt really deeply engrossed in this story because it is the story of my home. And it's also kind of a shameful story about my home place. I wrote an opening chapter, close third, on Ray Takahashi coming home from the war, as you said. And then I decided I had no right to be that close to Japanese or Japanese American characters. I didn't have the right to do that. So I flipped the whole script on it. And chapter two says, you know, I wrote that when I was, you know, 20 years old and just came back from Vietnam. And you're introduced to an entirely different narrator who's a white male wannabe writer who is trying to work on a book. And it allowed me to be fallible in my knowledge about Japanese culture. And it also allowed me to sort of acknowledge the privilege of whiteness in this country, which is a major theme of the whole book. You know, there's a conception that I had early on, which may or may not be true, but my thinking was, if we had dropped, given the atomic bomb, We were able to drop it twice on Japan with probably very little feeling of guilt at the time. Would we have dropped two atomic bombs on Europe to stop the war? Like, I don't think so. I don't think white America would have done that, because what we do as a culture is we other Asia constantly. Edward Said calls it Orientalism, right? And it's this conception of Asia as other, which means we don't have to grieve in the same way for the other, right? So we've mostly transferred that feeling from the Far East to the Middle East now. But we still have this sort of sense of who we can grieve for and who we don't have to grieve for. And you see it even in news broadcasts when a nail bomb goes off somewhere and they make sure they tell you, like, and two Americans. You know, 57 people were killed, including two Americans, as if the two Americans make any difference at all, except that's underscoring sort of our sense of who we are as a people. This kind of collective we, which is meant to be inclusive, but it's actually very, very exclusive, right? We Americans usually means in this country a particular kind of sort of white, heteronormative, often male person, and everyone below that is in some way other to a greater or lesser degree.
So John Fraser, the white man who has come back after the Vietnam War, takes us on this journey through what happened to these two families, one Japanese, one white, on this farm, how they were friends, internment divided and separated them. Then we're fast forwarded into really understanding the role of the two mothers and what happened to some of the children. But I want to say, through all of that, for me, Ray continues to be the lightning rod for everything I feel, everything I question about myself, everything I realize I didn't know and shouldn't have known. So in that way, something's accomplished that makes you set the book down and think, where did I just go? Where did I just go?
Thank you. It's interesting you say that, because in the structural conceit of the novel, Ray is theoretically the only character that John Fraser is making up whole cloth. He's, you know, the narrator is with Ray's mother,
right,
and with Helen Wilson, the matriarch of the white family.
That owned the farm where the Takahashis lived and worked.
Yeah, and it's really the story of a friendship that goes south for reasons of race, but it's also the story of a young man who comes back from Vietnam. He understands that he has been involved in the wholesale killing of an other people. I'm air quoting. You can't see me air quoting at home, but I'm air quoting. And he is trying desperately to not have to think about what he did in Vietnam, which was just he followed orders and he did what you do as a soldier. And in humanizing Ray, he's essentially trying to humanize his own experience in Vietnam, to acknowledge that, yes, these faceless Asians that he had a part in killing in Vietnam were people.
I'm talking with Christian Kiefer. His previous award-winning novels are The Animals and The Infinite Tides. This is wonderful that you have a book signing and conversation event. It's happening this week, Thursday, February 13th, at the Public Library in Lincoln.
That's correct? Right.
At 6:30. So back to that topic of conversations where you as a white man think you have no business.
Yeah.
I'm going to bring up another one where you jumped right in. Five books about mothers who are also human beings. This is an article that you wrote, and you do say, I would like to acknowledge that maybe it's problematic for a male writer to choose books about mothers. However, Phantoms, as much as it's about race and history, is about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about what a mother will do to protect herself, her children, and her family. It's about how one mother will face boldly another mother to say, what happened? What did you do?
That's right.
Why? And what came of it? And gosh, there are so many strong narratives in this book, and that's a super powerful one.
Yeah, the matriarch narrative in this book is fierce. And I can't quite recall how I came to it, but I knew pretty quickly that the mothers in the story, that it was really a story about the agency of women, motherhood, and access to certain kinds of power in terms of defining and defending who you think of as your family.
And these two mothers are Evelyn Wilson, who is the mother of the white family that owns the land, and Kimiko Takahashi.
Yes, the mother of the Japanese family.
Friends.
And the Japanese family and the white family in the book essentially work so closely together that the children and the husbands become sort of best friends to the extent that they consider each other family. Evelyn and Kimiko less so. Evelyn in particular is very distrustful about the whole relationship and the idea that somebody as other as this Japanese family could be considered family to them is kind of anathema to her.
They sort of hold the place for the bigger attitudes or stereotypes or fears of the country. And then ultimately, because I don't want to give away what happens, they end up being the power brokers in decisions that ripple out and affect every other family member's life in really shocking ways. This is actually a mystery. It reads,
yeah, kind of is.
The reveal comes at the end.
Yeah, and hopefully it's an inevitable reveal. I mean, I hope that by the time you get to the end, the reveal isn't a reveal. I hope you've relegated or prepared your heart for what's coming at that point.
Yes, it doesn't mean it hurts any less.
My mom called me in tears saying that the book just broke her. Yeah.
Yeah, I hope you gathered that from my summary too, that you have to just sit with yourself for a while. Whose story is this? Whose voice do readers hear the most?
Well, the book ends with kind of a tacit acknowledgement of white narrative. John Fraser narrates this book and the book ends with him. Mm-hmm. It ends with him enjoying his unearned privilege.
Of having been a witness and a weaver of history.
He's a witness to history. He also understands by the end of the book that he really wasn't actually involved in this story. The models that I had were books like William Styron's Sophie's Choice, which is narrated by the downstairs neighbor, Stingo, who's narrating about Sophie and her boyfriend. And it's an amazing story, but he's not really involved in the narrative. And I liked that idea. I liked the idea of a narrator being as close to a story as you can get that's not really yours to tell, which is the whole issue with a lot of white writers sort of trying to cross that boundary. It's like, how do you cross that boundary in a way that's respectful? There's a huge controversy right now with American Dirt.
I was sitting here in my mind thinking about whether to bring that up, and I don't want the rest of our time to go there, but that is that same conversation.
That's the same conversation, right. And, you know, with my book, I wrote this book with my friends who are writers of color in mind. I sent it out exclusively to women and writers of color to get blurbs. If any of them had told me that I shouldn't publish it, I would have stopped for sure, because it's not my story to tell. And I think I did as good a job as possible in terms of the research and whatnot, but it's still research. You know, it's not lived experience.
Yeah, and it's deeply researched. Yeah. And I think we could continue for a long time talking about this book. Again, I'll encourage people to join you at the Public Library in Lincoln on Thursday at 6:30. We have a couple minutes left. I do want to talk about the fact that your youngest child has been in a really remarkable survival battle.
Yeah.
And you've been very public about it. If you would talk for a moment about Vivian Eden Kiefer, the little girl that came after six older brothers.
Yeah. So number seven, our only girl, she was born with Down syndrome, heart defect, had open heart surgery at 6 months, which is not uncommon with Downs. Let's see, almost died of pneumonia the following winter, and then went into the hospital for many months and was finally diagnosed with pediatric pulmonary hypertension. Mm. So the thing with Vivian is she feeds through a tube in her stomach. We've got oxygen on hand all the time. She's a rock star, so she stays up till 5 o'clock in the morning, after which we all go to bed. The thing with having a child like that, and I'm sure certain listeners can relate, you never know if she's having an off day or if she's dying and we need to race down to Stanford Hospital. And that's just kind of like the daily stress. So my wife and I are checking in every day going, like, how's Vivian doing? Like, oh, she seems a little off. Does she look pale to you? Does she look puffy? If she does, maybe her heart is beating out of rhythm, or it's beating too hard, or maybe fluid is gathering around it. Maybe her pulmonary hypertension medication isn't working. And so we've been traveling back and forth to Stanford, staying in hotels, staying at the Ronald McDonald House. As everybody in America knows, medical expenses, even if you've got good insurance, they still hemorrhage you out, for sure. So we've had some help with GoFundMe, people contributing and sort of helping us get sort of through the period. But it is ongoing. It's terrifying when I think about it, but mostly it's just kind of daily life, you know?
How old is she now?
She'll be 3 next month. Mm. And when I come home from here, all my clothes will go into the wash and I'll go into the shower, because if she gets sick, it's dire. Mm. So, everything is like boiled. Yeah.
So that's the centerpiece of your life.
That's
it. The writing continues. The boys are all busy in their lives.
And yeah.
You
Maniacs.
And your wife have this sort of interesting choreography.
Yeah, it's a feral house.
I think that it's remarkable. You've been so public about it. If people look on your Twitter feed on Christmas Eve, you posted a picture of just the kind of debris of all of her health care.
Yeah.
And I think it's an amazing real life story that you're sharing with everybody.
Thank you. Mm.
So what are you working on next book-wise?
Oh, well, I tried to take a break so that my wife could take up more space in our lives.
Lovely.
Because I take up a lot of space. But I've come to realize that if I'm not writing, I don't have anything to do. Mm. So I accidentally started a new book, which takes place in the 1880s in the Amazon. So this is all predicated on me trying to get to the Amazon to do the research. But that's what's next.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, thank you.
It is a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks so much. So good to be back.
We'll make sure that the next conversation is soon, because life is fluid and it's changing fast for everybody.
Sure is.
All the best wishes to your family and little Vivian.
Thank you.
That is Dr. Christian Kiefer, and you can find links to more about his novel Phantoms at capradio.org/insight. Again, the public library in Lincoln, Thursday night to meet him at 6:30. That's Insight for today. I'm Beth Ruyak. NPR's special coverage of the New Hampshire primary begins live on Cap Radio at 5. Thanks for joining us.